Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to December 2016 edition of Poet Radio. My name is Chris, and today in the studio we have a Hudson Valley luminary, as far as I'm concerned. Shiv Mirabito is with us from Woodstock, New York, and he's here to read us some poems and speak with us a little about his poetic projects over on the other side of the river, a little south of here, and on the other side of the world as well. Shiv is a global traveler, making pilgrimages to India and other points east on an annual basis for many years now. And I've been anxious to have him on the program because he is a local publisher, a performer, a kind of central figure in the Woodstock poetry scene, and a great admiration for what he does, how he lives his life. And Shiv, glad you're here. How are you?
Namaste. I'm great. Thank you for having me, and namaste to everyone out there. I'm very honored to be here to read some poetry and talk about the scene, the poetry scene in Woodstock, and we have a very nice scene there. I always joke with people that everybody in Woodstock's an artist, musician, or poet, or all three, and it's quite an interesting scene.
Yeah, that's true. And one of the things that you do that so makes it even more interesting is your Shivastan Poetry Ashram, which runs off a kind of a back street, you know, right away from the main drag of Woodstock.
Yeah, we have a nice little scene there, and it's also where I live, and it's a bookshop essentially, but it's also a community gathering place for poets and artists and different creative people. The way I describe it is the Shivastan Poetry Ashram is a bookshop, art gallery, gift shop, and grassroots community cooperative promoting poetry and poets, friendship, equality, and wisdom and compassion for all beings, located in central Woodstock, New York.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of gatherings. In the summer, we have all these bonfires with open mic poetry in the round, around a bonfire, and vegetarian potlucks, and lots of very interesting people coming by, and all kinds of events.
It's a very grassroots, word of mouth thing. It's not the type of thing you would be hearing an advertisement for, or, you know, it gets word spreads through the community. And
It's a word of mouth thing. And I kind of base it on when I was a teenager, I lived on Allen Ginsberg's farm in Cherry Valley, New York. And I kind of base it on his cooperative scene that he had there, where it was open to poets and artists and musicians to come and share and be with each other. And it's quite a fun scene.
That must have been quite something to live up there in Cherry Valley.
It was pretty mind-blowing, and that at that time, I was just a, you know, redneck upstate teenager, and totally opened my mind to, you know, traveling the world and studying Buddhism and Hinduism, and that's where also I met the first vegetarians I ever met. I became vegetarian, and the first people I ever met who had dreadlocks, and I stopped cutting my hair then in like 1986.
And now your hair goes down to your ankles, I bet.
Yeah, it drags on the ground, actually.
Amazing. Well, I knew that some of your connection with Ginsberg, and maybe that's why I pulled out this chant that's going on in the background, or has been going on in the background the past few minutes. That's his Pacific High Studio Mantras, his recording from Holy Soul Jelly Roll. So no coincidence, I suppose, that must have been.
Well, I personally feel that he's extremely influential in American culture, and I always say to young people, you know, you really should study his work and his life, because he almost single-handedly started the hippie movement, I think, and his whole life's work was community and equality and human rights and helping others. And that's what I try and also share today with all my group of friends in Woodstock.
The amazing thing for me, and it would be different than it was for you, is that the thing that got me interested in Ginsberg in a real serious way was his intelligence. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
And once I saw that, that I never really thought of poets as brilliant before I encountered Ginsberg. You know, I thought of poets as artistic, creative, you know, maybe sometimes whimsical, but never brilliant. And so that made its impression. You know, when I encountered his poetry before that, I didn't necessarily have the ability to understand it just because of my own background and, you know, what I had been exposed to. So it was radical in that sense, but almost in a way where I couldn't embrace it. But once I started to realize there was a real substance and awareness to it, it became completely different. And then, you know, of course, he became my teacher and whatnot. So that was good. But yeah, even for those young people, you say, look at this, they, you know, hopefully they'll have more of a context for it than I did, you know, in a way. So this all leads us to your, I guess maybe first, let's go into some poems.
Okay.
I know you have a few different types of poems to read today, so we'll start in one place and chat a bit, perhaps, and, you know, go on to other areas.
Well, a lot of focus of my life is since I was young in university, I went to India and Nepal, and I've been going every year to India and Nepal since 1988. And I just love it there, and I love the culture and the ancient spiritual history there. And so a lot of my poems have that kind of theme of India and Nepal and Buddhism and Hinduism. And that's why also when I met Ira Cohen, and I lived for several years in Woodstock with the wife and son of Angus MacLeese, they had lived in Nepal in the 70s and had published a lot of poetry with their small presses there, like Star Streams and several different small presses, and which are very rare now and hard to find. But so as I kept going every year to India and Nepal, I felt like I should be doing something too, like publishing my own poetry. Then I realized, some people said to me, oh, you have a vanity press? And I thought, ew, I don't want to have a vanity press. So I started publishing all different friends of mine and doing it as a public service to poets so that they could get their work out there for other people to read. And so my small press is called Shivastan Press, and it's based in Kathmandu. All the printing is done there on handmade paper. And then it's distributed. My biggest distributor is City Lights Books in San Francisco. And so that's kind of the thrust of what I've been doing with the publishing scene. And I always like to start off a poetry reading by reading my homage to Ganesha, because Ganesh is the god of good luck, and it's always good to start things by honoring him. So this one's called Homage to Ganesha. Ganganapataye namo nama. I bow and offer respect to all-powerful Ganesh, although he is not as powerful as his mother, Parvati, who created him, or his father, Shiva, who created everything. Ganesh is the lord of the jungle, our deluded samsaric minds. Ganesh is the primordial wild elephant within each of us. Ganesh is the largest land mammal ever, riding on a tiny mouse, removing obstacles, real or imaginary, with a look from his loving eyes or a wave of his benevolent hand. Ganesh is the god of all wisdoms. Ganesh reminds us all life is interdependent. Ganesh reminds us all life is sacred. Ganesh reminds us that we all have a primordial wild elephant within each of us that is tamed by the prodding of culture sitting on our backs. Ganesh reminds us to be aware. Ganesh reminds us to be wise and compassionate and to beware of the non-psychedelic. Ganesh says, everything is possible. Gan Ganapataye Namo Nama. So let's see, maybe I will read a few more poems in the India-Nepal theme.
What is it like with this viewpoint, you suppose, of beware of the non-psychedelic? I mean, we must beware of just about everything, right?
Well, yes, of course, you need to be aware. That's what beware means, right? And that actually is a quote from a Hindu yogi named Ganesh Baba, who was the guru of our friends Ira Cohen and also Peter Lamborn Wilson. And he was an Indian yogi who circulated around the New York area in the 70s. And he was a psychedelic, and he taught, knowledge of the psychedelic. And so much of life is psychedelic.
Well, that's true. More, in a way, beneath the surface than on the surface, or something you kind of catch out of the corner of your eye rather than walking down the streets of...
Yeah.
I mean, you live in Woodstock, so Woodstock is a little bit different than, yeah, say, Hudson or Rhinebeck or Red Hook.
New Age. And people say, oh, do you believe in miracles or something like that? And when you think about it, everything in life is a miracle. That we breathe air, that blood pumps through our veins, that the train is going by right now.
Yeah.
So many miracles.
Well, of course, but... This is advanced thinking, right? And this is what the yogi's getting at.
Right. It's appropriate that the train is going by because a bit of my personal history, I was born on the railroad tracks in a small town called Norwich, New York. And my family is Sicilian, and they came here to work on the railroads around 1900. And so it's so nice to hear the train going by. It's an interesting...
cosmic connection.
Bit of personal history too, right?
Very good, very good. Well, let's continue with some more of the poems. It looks like you're reading from, this is a book of yours, The Transcendental Tiger?
Yeah, this is a book of mine that I put out several years ago, Transcendental Tiger. And a lot of my books, all my books are published on handmade paper by Shivastan Press. And, if you go online, you could find them, definitely. Or you could come by the Shivastan Poetry Ashram in Woodstock if you're interested in taking a look at them. So this next poem I'm going to do is one about traveling in Kathmandu. And it's called Sleeping Around. One year when I was visiting Kathmandu, when I was young, brash, adventurous, and stupid, I decided to sleep around at the power places of the Kathmandu Valley. Sleeping outside by the Buddhist Bodhinath Stupa, some Tibetans thought I was a beggar and threw coins onto my blanket. Sleeping in one of the small stone temples at Pashupatinath, the abode of Shiva as the Lord of Animals, with my head on a lingam near the foggy Bagmati River, some unknown yogis cuddled up nearby. Sleeping outside by the burning grounds, beside the Vishnumati River, below the ancient Bijeshwari Temple, I read The Life of Marpa all night and waited for the hungry ghosts to devour my ego. I tried to sleep in the woods next to the Swayambhu Stupa, but the Bhutanese monks persuaded me to sleep on the floor of the oil lamp-lit shrine room in their monastery. Because ghosts. The next night, sleeping outside on grassy Manjushri Hill next to a small stupa, a baby monkey pulled my hair to awake me at dawn. Finally, sleeping on top of the Shiva Temple Pagoda Pyramid in Kathmandu Durbar Square, which looks exactly like the tall Mayan pyramids of Palenque or Teotihuacan, where 108 steps up is the platform where homeless Nepalis sleep around the rarely used Shiva Ling temple. I watch the rickshaw wallas glide around until 3 a.m., and then all was quiet in Kathmandu. We curled up on some straw in the chilly air and then realized that the hungry ghosts are everywhere, without and within, turning over fitfully the rest of the long, cold night. I arose before dawn and scratched my neck uncontrollably as the hungry fleas bit my flesh and drew my blood into their eager stomachs. But they were probably my mother or lovers in a past life anyways. Enjoy, hungry ghosts, enjoy. So let's see, I'll carry on with some more India poems. And this one's called Cell Phones on the Ganga. Over a billion strong, Mother India is evolving out from her ancient agrarian past into her cyber capitalist future. Her Silicon Valley is 108 times bigger than California's and lined with proper pubs where well-dressed students and office workers sit and sip foreign beers while chatting in English on their mobiles. Even Brahmin priests and babas have cell phones. Almost everyone has international cable TV, DVDs, and ubiquitous satellite dishes, even in the dirt floor shack slums of Mumbai and Calicut. The young prefer Baywatch, MTV, and CNN to the Vedas, Ramayana, and the Gita. They prefer Coke and Pepsi to chai, and not only the foreigners drink the Coca-Cola company bottled water. The Fundamentalist National Socialist Party protests Valentine's Day as an invasion of Western values, but the new generation is not stupid. They know it's not about love and tradition. America is about sex and money. Here's one I wrote about Kathmandu several years ago because in 2001 there was this huge murder of the royal family. And so that was a big game changer in Nepalese culture. So this is a poem I wrote about it. It's called Royal Murder. Kathmandu is burning. Like a simmering pot, rising and rising, bubbling and boiling, until royal murder strikes. A long overdue revolution is coming. Some say the crown prince was really, really angry, while others might say he was a blue-blooded, gun-obsessed alcoholic junkie. Whatever his motive, condition, or reason, killing your own mother and father and historically divine Vishnu avatar is spiritual and national treason. But we all know royal murder and intrigue in a military monarchy is an age-old tradition. A devout Hindu may say it was their karma, the unfolding lotus of their odd royal dharma. To live in opulent palaces, study at Eton, and possess the best of everything. While outside of Kathmandu, the hard-working farmers' poor children are ill, uneducated, and starving. The Nepali communists want land reform and an end to economic oppression, while the Nepali royals want privilege and immunity from prosecution for their own corruption. They say the new king, Gyendra, was the biggest smack dealer in Southeast Asia. And his son, the Crown Prince Paris, is a hit-and-run murderer with selective amnesia. Unfortunately, the scenario does not bode well for the entire Himalaya. Many Buddhists do not like that the royal family is so pro-China. But the traditional Brahmins will still mourn with their elaborate puja, and the young middle-class intellectuals will protest and march for change, for the fall of the old ways, just like what happened in Russia. Kathmandu is burning, and the murdered king and queen dance as yab-yum skeletons in heaven between Shiva and Parvati and Vishnu and Lakshmi, and look down on their shocked subjects very, very sadly. And since I wrote that poem, of course, Nepal did have a big revolution, Maoist revolution, and the king was ousted in 2006, and the Maoist party is in charge again now. The head of the Maoist party is the prime minister now. His name's Pushpa Kamal Dahal. And it's very fascinating there. The politics are very crazy, like here in America. And I was there last year during the big earthquake.
Yes, I remember.
And that was the scariest thing that ever happened to me.
No doubt.
And so I love going back every year and seeing how things are progressing. And, you know, they still need help there. Been trying to raise funds to help people rebuild. If you're interested, come by the Shivastan Poetry Ashram and we could talk about it. And
it's got to be amazing to have this experience. I mean, you've been going every year since the late 1980s, right?
Yes.
So over time, you must see a lot of, you know, ebb and flow, progress, regress, you know, hopefully more progress, but change nonetheless. And it comes through in your poems and also gives you a type of advantage in the writing of the subject, because all of a sudden you can dip in one poem to a lot of different experiences, right? Like,
yes.
The first poem you read, I think it was, it seemed like you were catching moments throughout time. It wasn't capturing a moment in time, but rather several moments and through different periods of time. So that's to me that's interesting and expansive.
Well, it's so fascinating being there in the culture, because at the same time that there's all these ancient monuments and ancient traditions happening everywhere around you, there's all this modernity happening too. And people wanting to join in the world technology culture. Even the bicycle rickshaw guys have cell phones now. And
bicycle rickshaw Uber type arrangements.
Yep, exactly. It's pretty wild. And here I want to read one more poem about Nepal that kind of speaks about that, about the changes that are happening there. This is one about an old woman that I had stayed with. She had a beautiful traditional house on the edge of Kathmandu Valley. And she had seen a lot of the ancient ways changing. This one's called Ama Nomiji. The carpet factory built a bridge across the stream to her house, where she had once crossed on a fallen log. Her tiny eyes are bright and hopeful, and surrounded by deep wrinkles that echo the ancient Nepali Himalaya. And tears have run down her valleys, like the Kali Kandaki and the Sri Bagmati. But at this time, she is Shanti. Above her small swaddled head is an orange clay niche. And there rests a large quartz crystal lingam, splattered with red and orange offerings, surrounded by tiny yellow flowers. She sighs deeply, inhaling on a Yak brand cigarette through her clenched fist, looking off into the distance, the distant future. At this time, she is Shanti. And I guess I could keep going with some India theme stuff. India and Nepal.
Did you write poems about the earthquake experience?
I wrote some prose stuff, but I haven't really written any poems about it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess there'll be a time when I will.
And it was high drama, right? You weren't sure you were going to be able to get out. You had to,
Yeah, I was on the third floor of a six-story cement building, and I just imagined that the floors would pancake down and I would be stuck between the floors. And the earthquake lasted over a minute, almost 2 minutes, and that seemed like an eternity. And I could barely stand up because the building was shaking so much, and I just didn't know what would happen. And I thought, well, this is it. I'm definitely going to die. What should I do? What should I think about? Should I say my mantras or should I just try to stay very positive. And then after it stopped, everybody ran out of the buildings, of course. And then I had to sleep outside on the street for a week. And you realize how difficult it is as a traveler if you're in a country where there's a natural disaster, because there were all the restaurants closed, all the shops closed. There was no Wi-Fi, no anything, no telephones, no newspapers, no way to be in contact with anyone or anything, and no food. And I didn't eat for days, and there were constant aftershocks every 15 minutes, half an hour. And it was pretty wild. And they're still having earthquakes now, and they're predicting that maybe there'll be an even bigger one. Because, of course, the Indian subcontinent is shoving against Asia, and that's what's forcing the Himalayas up. And that's just the geology of the situation.
Right. Well, what an extreme experience. I mean, that's few people have anything like that to, compare it with. I mean, I was actually in a major earthquake in the Bay Area in 89, and I know how shocking that was, and half of the town, the downtown of where I lived, collapsed. I can't imagine everything collapsing, right. And being so far from home. At least I was where I lived, and people, we could make it work. Even in the hurricanes in the last couple of years in New Jersey were greatly affected, but nothing like you experienced.
Well, I was actually very lucky because the neighborhood I was in, most of the buildings were new, so they had the iron rebar in the buildings among the cement and brick, and most of the buildings did not fall down. But in the mountains, that's where the real damage was, and of course the old temples fell, and any place that didn't have steel reinforcement in the building, they fell down.
Right.
But I was very lucky.
At the time, I was working on a project with Peter Wilson in Woodstock, and every day would pass, we were wondering about you, and even for us, it was precarious.
Got in the local paper and everything, people saying, oh no, did anybody hear how Shiv is? And then,
it was such a great relief to hear that you were marked as
finally,
okay.
Finally, I was able to contact a friend and said, put it up on Facebook and tell people that I'm okay. And so let's see, that'll lead into one more poem about India, which is about, people. One good thing about the earthquake was I was in a very spiritual area. So Buddhists and Hindus realize, of course, we're all going to die. And they're not afraid of death, and death is part of life. They encounter death all the time. So this is a poem about the main burning ghat, because they cremate there. The main burning ghat in India, in Varanasi, on the Ganges River. This one's called Manikarnika Ghat. The eternal flame burns here since before time began, since before the advent of writing, and anybody who is anybody wants to be cremated at Manikarnika Ghat in Varanasi, India. On the black terrace steps stretching up from the cool green Ganga River, bodies are burnt, big and small, young and old, day and night, until there is nothing but glowing ashes. At first the corpse is wrapped in glittery gold cloth and gently placed upon well-stacked wood. With the cries of Ram, 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 Ram. Then immediate families, heads shaved, wearing only a seamless white cloth, mourn silently, watching the flames devour ears, fingers, toes, arms, legs. Sweaty men use bamboo poles to poke and prod the burning body's wayward limbs, and sometimes fold them in half to keep the burning blob contained. And finally, as the ashes are pushed into the Ganga, men slosh around in the thick black primordial ooze, looking for gold jewelry or stray coins of the dead. Monolithic stacks of wood surround these burning grounds like a fortress, the primeval fortress of Yama, the god of death. Manikarnika's name comes from a deep pool behind the flaming pyres where Shiva's wife Sati's jewel earring fell as he carried her lifeless burning body from South India to Tibet. And in the small temple above, an old man rings bells and lights camphor offerings to an ancient Shiva lingam, and beside that is the round red sandstone observation deck built by the British, where idle men take naps and play cards and drink cheap whiskey. And above that is the four-story building where Allen Ginsberg fed a banana to a wild monkey early in the morning in 1961. And behind that is an alley where Peter Orlovsky bathed and fed a dying leper. And on this sacred mandala, countless thousands of Mahasiddhas and yogis sat still and meditated on the temporary nature of life. And every year in monsoon time, the mighty green Ganga swells and rises 100 feet, sweeping away all the ashes, all the lives, and the eternal flame must be carried in a copper pot up to the top terrace, where death still takes place every day, rain or shine. And yes, death is part of life. We all know that. And maybe I should switch to something a little bit more upbeat. I do a lot of the scene in Woodstock. There's a lot of performance poetry. And we all love to get together and perform poetry, whether it's at our local Harmony Cafe, or in a bar or an art gallery or around a bonfire. So I find that a lot of poems about poetry seem to be very popular with other poets.
Yeah, but it's okay with, you don't have to get all, the dark side is okay on this program.
Right.
Shiv. The amazing thing for me in hearing the poems is it gives us such a juxtaposition for the way, the differences between Eastern and Western culture. So,
yes.
And we can begin to imagine what if there was a more of a happy medium rather than the extremes, a type of spiritual consciousness on the ground level, combined with the natural elements that you depict mm-hmm. in the poem. So that it's okay. I wasn't, I don't think any of myself or any of the listeners out there are too worried. Mm-hmm.
Well, I like to stay more upbeat anyways, and I have a lot of, try to have a lot of humor element in my poetry also. So this is one that I wrote that sounds kind of sad, but it's actually ironic. And a lot of times it's difficult when you're reading poetry to people, and you might say things that are shocking, and people are like, oh, you really believe that? And it's like, no, that's ironic. It's called, you know what I mean? It's
I believe
the opposite of what I'm actually saying. It's a joke. So, and here's one poem like that called Poets Have No Friends. Poets have no friends. Beauty is a series of hypotheses. Poets have no friends. They hate you for saying too much. They hate you for not saying enough. They don't care about your inner feelings. They never show up at your readings. They think you are crazy. They think you are weird. They think you are self-obsessed. And they know that you cannot rest until you read them your latest poem and tell them the latest poetry scene gossip. They don't know, and they don't care, how urgent your need is to share. And they don't know how much you love them. They don't know the pain of a poet's love. And hopefully it's not too painful to be a poet. Here's one that I always think is fun to read.
It's painful to be a human at this stage.
I mean, isn't
everybody going to hip up to the gospel noble truth on that one?
Right. Life is suffering. Even when things, you get what you want, someday it'll be gone. So that's definitely a Buddhist truth. Here's a fun one. A lot of times I say to people, hey, come to the poetry reading. And they're like, most, you know, normal people who aren't poets, I mean. And they're like, I don't know. And so nowadays it's getting to be like, you know, it's difficult to get people out to poetry readings sometimes, but poets will always show up. So this one is called, hey, remember when poetry was fun? Remember when poetry was fun? And remember when John Q. General Public didn't think readings were less fun than going to the dentist? Remember when poetry was a radical revolutionary act and poets were banned and arrested for speaking their truth? Remember when poets went out to have fun and drink and smoke and get wasted and get laid and didn't expect to get paid? Remember when there were radical lesbians, engaged environmentalists, vegetarians, and activists and transvestites who rocked out with their cocks out? Remember when poets cared and dared to be different? Remember when poets alchemically transformed words into metaphysical mercury and changed the world? Remember when Allen Ginsberg said, I here now declare the end of the war, and he meant it. Remember when poets loved each other and didn't want to just spew and leave? Remember when poetry wasn't all whining and complaining and codependent crap about your love affair with your cat? Remember when there were cowboy poets and pirate poets and punk rock poets and performance artists who smashed watermelons and juggled chainsaws as they read? Remember when poetry was a catalyst for hope and for change, and everybody hoped to have a good time, and when it wasn't fun, we made it fun? Remember when poetry was fun? So that's a fun poem about poems.
And people love that in the audience. The crowd goes wild. That's the general response.
Yeah. People love that one because they're like, hey, wait a minute. I think poetry's fun. So, you know, kind of gets their ire up a bit.
It seems like that poem would speak to, I mean, it could speak to anybody, but like I can see a younger person who say, maybe a little disgruntled by poetry scene and poets being uninteresting or something, they could get on board with that one.
Right. Yeah. They never think it's as interesting as TV or whatever.
One thing I notice about Woodstock when I go to readings over there is that the crowd is a little bit older. So maybe you're trying to rouse people a little bit to point them.
Hopefully. I mean, it used to be young people loved poetry and they wanted to be a revolutionary and artistic and, you know, show how creative they are by reading poetry. I actually have a poem about that.
Oh, cool.
It's called "Why Don't the Youth Like Poetry Night?" Why? I don't mean to be ageist, believe me. And how come in a room of over 30 poets, there are only 3 people under 50? As a Marxist anthropologist, I wonder, what does it mean? How can we encourage the local youth to speak their own truth? Are they afraid to be aware? Maybe they just don't care. Maybe their undeniable future is a scary, unspeakable nightmare. That's a short one about that.
And not only is it like a undeniable future, it could be a mythological future, the rate we're going.
Right. Yes. And I do
An undeniable mythological future.
Yes. And I do have some, definitely have some political poems I want to read.
We're doing pretty well with time, I'd say about 15 more minutes. So, We can go on with the poems.
Okay. Yeah, I want to read one more about poetry because I know poets love poems about poetry. So this one was
some poets.
This
do,
one yeah. was right. This one was actually inspired by our friend George Quasha, who has a series where he videotapes people and gets them to say what poetry is.
That's right.
And this poem is called "Poetry Is." To know what poetry is, you don't need to be the Pablo Picasso of purple poesy, or the Vincent van Gogh of vocal verse, or the Gertrude Stein of sexy stanzas, or the Emily Dickinson of dictatorial diction, or the T.S. Eliot of elusive elocution, or the Allen Ginsberg of howling hipster grammar, or the Lawrence Ferlinghetti of free form, or even the William Burroughs of buggery beat balderdash. But you must remember the golden rule of all time. It is a heinous crime to use too much rhyme. And a truth you must trust is a true poet must always avoid alliteration, especially when expressing inebriated indignation. Poetry is art, and art is life. Nothing is true, and everything is permitted. One should never tell a lie where the buffalo roam unless it is in a poem. Poetry is the window to your soul. Poetry is an all-encompassing black hole. Poetry is always the penultimate goal. Uh-oh, and it sounds like the cops are coming now.
Yeah, fire engines.
Oh, fire engines.
I don't know. I hope things
we're
are
setting
right
this place
there.
On fire with
seems
this poetry.
Seems like something's going on. And that is a humorous poem there, Shiv, because is it a poem about poetry, but a poem, it's kind of self-effacing itself.
Yes.
Right?
That's always good, I think. And here's
it's not taking itself too seriously, but at the same time making a point.
Yeah, I can't stand when poets take themselves too seriously. Here's a case in point. Here's a couple of very funny little poems. This one's called "Poetry Revolution." Ginger Rogers said to Fred Astaire, "I don't see why anyone should care if President Obama wears any underwear. What if the emperor has no clothes? What if a rose is not a rose? I think the only solution is a poetry revolution." And this one is called "Art."
He says this gesturing with his fist in the air.
And this one is another short one called "Art Has No Opposite." One and or two. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted. Don't be outwitted. Cavemen on the run. A philosopher's work is never done. So from there, since we kind of thinking about time, maybe I will read a couple poems that I wanted to read. Maybe
yeah, sure.
One political one.
I noticed you slipped some rhymes in there, Shiv.
I like poems that rhyme personally.
All right.
One thing I was going to say too is, I never really studied poetry. And one time I actually took a class with our friend Ed Sanders, and he said he was going to teach us everything that he taught at Naropa and all that iambic pentameter and all that stuff. And I never learned any of that stuff. I never really learned anything about how to write poetry. I just know I like what I like. So let's see.
Well, Ed has some very formal ideas about poems, but seems to also have...
I think free verse is always fun.
Well, he writes songs, too. I mean, so...
Right.
A song has to do a certain thing.
Before I read my real political stuff, I think I want to read a couple more personal poems. This is kind of a fun one. It's called My New Play. I'm writing a one-act play about Pier Paolo Pasolini, Elsa Morante, and Anna Magnani's trip to India, early 60s. And in a cafe in Bombay, they're seated next to Allen Ginsberg, Peter Orlovsky, Gary Snyder, Joanne Kiger, and Timothy Leary. They chat and scat about this and that, when suddenly in walks Jean Genet with his Moroccan lover, Mohamed Abdullah, the boxer, just in from Marseille. And it's very outré in every way. I expect it to be a big success for decades on Broadway. And the studios will all have fights over the film rights. And someday I will accept my Academy Award for the best screenplay from India in absentia.
Fantasy poems.
Yes. Yes. I like rhyming sometimes. Here's another kind of funny one I wrote after the whole gay marriage thing came through, which, you know, human rights, let's all have equality. This one is called Happiness. I don't want to get married. I don't want to join the army. I don't want to be the president or rule the world. I don't want to be the king of curiosity. I don't want to wave any flag. I don't want to expand the empire. I don't want to tell anyone how to live their life. I don't want to take away anyone's rights. I don't want to steal anyone's thunder. I don't want to be the most famous or the richest man on earth. I don't want to live forever. I don't want a six-pack, a facelift, or Botox. I don't want to hate anyone who hates me. And I don't want everyone to love me. I just want everyone to be happy. And let's see. Then also...
That's a political poem?
Kind of.
Yeah?
Kind of, because, you know, human rights is a political issue.
No, absolutely.
And happiness also. You know, encouraging people to be happy is always a good thing.
Yeah, well, we hear, you know, you hear plenty of, you know, rhetoric in the media about politics and this side and that side. But, you know, in this country, the radical postulation never really happens, you know, and you don't hear political candidates, even the best of them, mostly not talking about the general... good mindset, happiness of the people. You know, they think that certain opportunities will lead to that, but it's not directly addressing that emotion.
Right.
It's all about jobs and opportunities and
right.
things like that. Capital.
Pursuit of happiness is supposed to be guaranteed, right? In our Constitution, or is that the Declaration of Independence? I can't remember. But yeah, right after the elections, of course, any thinking person would have a reaction, and any poet would probably write something about it. So I wrote a poem the very day after the election, because so many people I know were, you know, physically ill and crying for days, and I know a lot of people are still very upset, and anything could still happen. So this one is called Goodbye to Hope. I really, really, really cannot believe so many Americans believe in the horrible hate and injustice that he represents. It's truly mind-boggling that there are that many ignorant people with deplorable values in America. Why? He's not going to help you. It feels like our true American values of equality and compassion have just been assassinated. The only possible good thing is that now there will surely be a civil war that will bring the issues of human rights and justice for all into our everyday existence again. It will be like the revolutionary 60s all over again, except probably with another Great Depression and maybe World War III too. Goodbye to any progress we made under 8 years of Obama, and hello to the moral and financial bankruptcy of America. Goodbye to human rights in America, or any progress in positive race relations. Goodbye to any respect for women's rights, equal pay, or a woman's right to choose what happens to her own body. Goodbye to food stamps, public assistance, and Medicare. Goodbye to any minority rights, LGBTQ rights, any help or respect for the ill, infirm, or aged, or immigrants, or Muslims, or Native Americans, or people of color, or veterans, or the differently abled, or intellectuals, artists, etc., etc., etc. Goodbye to any meaningful interaction with the rest of the world except dictators. Goodbye to any respect for the earth or environmentalism. Goodbye to Planned Parenthood, and hello to the KKK. Goodbye to compassion, and hello to hate. The bullies now rule the playground. Michelle Obama said, "When they go low, we go high." I truly want to believe love conquers all. Let's hope so. But a revolution is what we really need.
And that one is a little more heavy, handed to you. But I will say that it's great to see these poems written out in pencil. You know, it's kind of a refreshing approach. Eventually, yeah. I imagine it will hit the computer and the internet. But
actually, that one I got printed in the Woodstock Times a couple weeks ago, because I was just so upset. I felt like we all need to share our opinion about what's going on. And you know, anything really could happen. I mean, I'm hoping that the Electoral College comes to their senses and, you know, tries to say that the winner of the popular vote is the one who should be president.
That's hopeful. That goes against the title of your poem anyway. You know, like, say goodbye to you. You're being...
That's ironic,
right,
obviously.
Right. And, so, good.
And
good.
Let's see. Here's another one.
Protest and survive, Shiv. You know?
Yeah. I mean, we have to all stand up for what we believe in. And here's one that's making fun of America, which I think is fine to do. You know, I've burnt flags before and done that kind of thing. You know, because we need to, it's our right in America, First Amendment right, to say what we believe. So here's one kind of making fun of, you know, the sadness that's going on in America now. And this one is called True American Values. I want to be free, free, free. I want lots of money, money, money. Can't we all agree? It's all about me. I pledge allegiance to my great country, one nation under perpetual slavery, united by uncompassionate apathy. Hey, it's not about bigotry. I know I am the crown of creation, and I have dominion over all that I see, and I am totally sure because I saw it on TV. I do not want to take any political action. I just want instant gratification. I want to be free, free, free. I want lots of money, money, money. Can't we all just agree? It's all about me. So that's a sad poem. I think it's kind of funny, right? But it's a little sad. How are we doing on time?
You know, we don't have lots more time. Looks like we're clocking in about a minute and a half or so. You have another short piece you want to read?
Okay, I would like to do one that's always a crowd pleaser, and it's a funny poem that I like to read this time of year because, you know, winter is coming.
Right, right.
And this is one that's a personal one. It's called "On All These Cold Nights to Come." Old man winter is coming. You could smell it in the crispy air, and you can feel it in your chilly bones. And everybody is looking for somebody hot to keep them warm on all these cold nights to come. Except for those of you that are already comfortably codependent. And on all of these cold nights to come, shivering, embryonic between cold bed sheets, my mind drifts. I think I'm dreaming. I hunger to spoon with you. I hunger to feel your body heat. I hunger to feel your skin on my skin. I hunger to feel your soft curls on my face. I hunger to feel your hot, gentle breath in my ear. But why am I kidding myself? Whenever I do share my bed with you, you hog the blanket and fart under the covers. I have no room to stretch my legs. You snore really loudly. Your afro tickles my nose, and your hot breath kind of stinks like tofu. I think that on all of these long, hard, cold nights to come, I'll just keep myself warm. All by myself, unless you strongly disagree.
Beautiful, Shiv. Beautiful. And I think a decent way to end the program, you know, given the coming season and the 3-degree night we're supposed to have. And, like all that. And you're on your way to India and Nepal in a couple weeks, right?
Yeah. No? I leave every year New Year's Eve. I fly to India to go hang out on the beach in Goa. And should be great. But my bookshop and art gallery and gift shop is still open in Woodstock, the Shivastan Poetry Ashram. So if anybody wants to come by, please come by.
It's great to have you on the program today. And this has been Poet Radio. And we'll call it off at that. Thanks so much.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
All right. You're in tune to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson. See you next month.